It is Saturday, July 7, 2012. It's time now for Geek Speak with Miles Elam, Ben Jaffe. My name's Lyle Troxell. Hey, geeks, how's it going?
Hi.
Okay, what happened to music?
You know, I'm trying to shorten down the podcast. Okay, I wasn't ready. this is Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on the program, we will be doing news about technology for the week of July 7th. Now, can we start the week July 7th, or should we really say the week of the previous week? I guess it's the previous week, up to July 7th. Yeah, there you go.
That's Miles,
the weekend
debate.
Of July 7th.
Ooh.
For Saturday, July 7th. All right, Miles Elam is a software engineer and political junkie, and Ben Jaffe is a web instructor and world traveler. And Miles, I'm going to start with you today. Tell me about desalination technology.
Well, see, now you just gave away the whole punchline.
Oh, darn.
Graphene, that material that we love to love. Done all sorts of things with regard to semiconductors, to things that you can that can conduct electricity in other ways. It can insulate.
This is just a molecule of carbon, right?
Yes, and you can make sheets out of it. So it makes a hexagonal pattern. But it's basically only one atom thick.
Right.
So a two-dimensional structure.
This sounds very similar to graphite, which is in pencils. Is there a similarity?
Well, they're both carbon.
Okay.
Yeah, they're all different forms of carbon, just like diamond is a carbon lattice.
Or a buckyballs or a nanotubes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
All right, so this is a structure of carbon, a molecular structure,
yeah, so
which
think
is just
of a
giant
carbon,
sheet.
Yeah, think of a carbon nanotube, but flatten it out.
No problem. So what cool things is graphene?
Graphene.
Graphene. What's graphene doing this week?
What it's doing this week is, or at least in the labs, it's not ready for production just yet. We're still not ready with our material science. But with regard to desalinization, right now, desalination, what we're doing right now is reverse osmosis. That's how we do most of our desalination.
So you basically make a porous membrane that can't hold, salt molecules can't get through. And over a period of time, water goes through it, but the salt doesn't.
Well,
and
you put it under high pressure.
Right.
Yeah. And well, with this, however, you don't have to use that much pressure because you can just arrange the graphene sheets in such a way that the holes are about the same size as water molecules, but not the size of salt.
And I'm assuming there's a lot more holes. So effectively, you get a more holy mesh. What I love about this kind of stuff, when we're talking molecular level, our intuition of how things would work actually doesn't, right? That's why we have these strange interactions with nanoparticles. Because when we get to that scale, quantum effects take over what our normal, everyday macro life feels like, and interesting thing happens. So graphene, how much better is this desalination system with graphene implemented or used?
It has potential of being somewhere around either two orders of magnitude or three orders of magnitude more efficient than reverse osmosis.
That's
really something.
So for the audience out there, order of magnitude would mean a power of 10.
So 10 times stronger, 20 times stronger.
Well, no.
100 times stronger.
Two orders of magnitude or three orders of magnitude, which means 10 to the second or 10 to the third. In other words, 100 times better up to 1,000 times better.
So we're talking about membranes that wouldn't have to have as much pressure, a lot more water flow, a lot more, basically better and easier desalination.
Yes.
Cool. Any bad side effects like cancer?
No. The only bad side effect is that we can't use it quite yet. We still have a few more hurdles to overcome.
Well, thanks for that update on technology. Let's do another update on technology. Ben, some particle physics news, please.
Yes, more molecular stuff for you guys.
And this is something no one heard of this week, right?
This is not breaking news or anything. As it turns out, the Higgs particle... I want to talk about the Higgs particle, but unfortunately, I can't say that we have found the Higgs particle because... they're scientists doing this research. Of course, if it walks like a Higgs particle and it talks like a Higgs particle, it
requires more funding.
Be a Higgs particle, but it may
and
not.
And if it has five levels of sigma, in other words.
Yes. So I will get to that, the orders of magnitude in just a second.
Ooh, okay.
Just wait and see. But just a quick summary. We talked about this a couple years ago. I think we had Linda Carpenter, a particle physicist, on, and we talked about the Higgs particle and all that stuff. If you see it in the news, you might see it as the God particle, which is completely a nonsensical statement from any kind of scientific perspective, but the media latched onto it. But basically, the reason that electrons, protons, and neurons have mass is because
neutrons.
I said neurons, did I say? Sorry. The reason electrons, protons, and neutrons have mass is allegedly because of this Higgs particle. So if the models are correct, then that's why. And then the way that we're actually trying to detect this thing is we're smashing particles together really, really, really fast at really, really high energies in these things called particle colliders. And it creates all of these various particles, and it creates allegedly supposedly a Higgs particle, right? And it's difficult to detect that in the mass of all of this other stuff. Basically, once the Higgs particle forms, it goes away very, very quickly. It disintegrates or decays very, very quickly. Kind of like when a firework goes off, it kind of goes like that, and then all the little pieces, you know, are suddenly invisible.
Goes like what? I couldn't really see very well over the radio.
Miles, so, I want to talk about fireworks later on in the show. But that's actually my geek bit, so stay
tuned.
But
let's also talk about how hard it is to find these subatomic particles, which is... like, we're talking about scale here, like how big it is. Think if you have a grain of sand and a football field.
Okay.
Okay. So if you were to look at the entire universe, our local cluster of galaxies would be like a grain of sand in the middle of that football field. That's how big the universe is.
Okay.
And if you had our galaxy within the local group, it's one grain of sand within that football field.
So a grain of sand within a football field, which is a grain of sand within another football, a bigger football field.
Right, at which point the solar system is a grain of sand inside the football field that is the Milky Way, and the Earth is a grain of sand inside the solar system. And the
right.
When you get down to the atomic scale, the same thing happens, where you have the overall space of an electron, even though it's an electron cloud, is... or even a proton, actually, is a grain of sand inside of a football field, which is the area of that atom.
Right.
And then if you had a neutron or a proton, and you're taking the subatomic particles from within there, like muons, gluons, then once again you have the football field or several with the grain of sand being that subatomic particle. So when they're talking about finding... these subatomic particles, we're talking...
really, really, really small.
Really, really small. Like, mind-bogglingly small.
Beyond your ability to comprehend how you can't comprehend the existence of something that you can't comprehend.
That's like the size of the universe.
Yeah. Okay. There are actually great videos about that, zooming from, like, the entire universe's size, going in, and eventually gets to a subatomic particle and everything, and it's all logarithmic scale.
So, colliders.
Particle colliders, we smash all this stuff together, everything explodes, and we're looking for this one particle decaying in a very specific way, right? So we can detect it. It has a very unique signature among all its noise. So the only way that we can actually pull that signal out is doing it again and again and again and again and again.
Okay.
And adding up all of the noise, averaging out all the noise, and trying to look for this little spike where we think this particle exists. And so the news is... that we have found with 5 sigma confidence, I'll explain that in a second, that this particle, that a particle that
matches
like
that pattern,
the particle right. that we are purporting may exist, is there. So basically, 5 sigma says that we can claim a 99.9999 confidence. So that's a one in a million chance.
Was that nine nines? Is that
that's six
nines, isn't it? Or is six nines?
Six, because we're 99.9, so 0.999999.
Okay.
Is 5 sigma.
It's a 1 in 3.5 million chance that it just happened by chance.
Or one
you're saying.
5 sigma is 1 in 1,000,000. And we have a 1 in 3.5 million. Alright, is that right?
Yeah. Wait,
yeah. Yeah. So
what you're saying is
we have a slightly higher than 5 sigma.
You can't really see this stuff. It's too small, but it has characteristics that can be detected.
Exactly.
And so when you see those characteristics, if you do it enough, you get more and more faith, if you will, that it's true. because it's repeatable.
Right. It's much the same thing as you would have for testing for some diseases. You're not testing for the virus particle. You're looking for the antigens in your blood, or you're looking for
a sign of it existing.
Yeah, something that is a trace.
And the more likely that sign emerges, the more likely it is that that's there.
Yeah, or this is
the complexity of why they keep on saying, we think we found it more testing relied. It's a continual process. Right.
Yeah, but so the gold standard is 5 sigma. After you get to 5 sigma accuracy, you can pretty much say, we are certain that this thing exists. This is a 1 in a million chance.
It's close enough that we can use it as a working model.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting thing. We've had this working existing model of physics for a while. And this is a confirmation of that model being accurate to the next step, right? So one of the things you try to do in science, you try to predict something that would be because of your theory. So you bring up a theory that fits all the evidence that exists. Then you say, is there anything I can do to predict something in the future based on this new theory? Oh, this is one. This particle, Higgs particle should exist.
You bring up a hypothesis. And then after you test it, it becomes.
Thanks for the grammar. And the point is
hey, we're talking about science here.
And so when this news hit, you know, I'm with a whole bunch of family and stuff. And they go, yeah, it's so exciting because this hit. So what does that mean, Lyle? And I go, it means we were right. I mean, it means nothing's changed.
Well, some people were right. Yeah, there were some people who hypothesized.
In fact, it would have been more interesting if we had been wrong about the Higgs boson.
The thing that I love about science, the thing that's so cool about science, is you got a whole bunch of people, most of them stubborn because they're people. People are stubborn, right? But we have...
No, they're not. I paid for an argument.
We have this way of looking at the world and detecting things and discovering things and everything that counteracts our own stubbornness and ultimately seeks truth.
Science.
Yeah.
It's science. Delicious. I should have a
science is real.
They might be giants.
Yeah, Miles, you've been obsessed with that, haven't you?
Yeah, when I came in today, you wouldn't even talk to me.
I came in, Miles walked in, he's like, oh my God, I got to show you this YouTube video. So he sat there and he sang the whole thing for me.
I was in the Name of a Giants mood and the Mesopotamians, it's just an awesome song.
Did sing the entire thing.
Because it's an awesome song.
Here's an eighth inch. We're going to play it in the mid-break. Go ahead and plug in your laptop.
Okay.
All right, but first, tell me about what's going on with court and Twitter.
Actually, I'm going to switch gears.
Do whatever you'd like.
I'm going to do something else, which is because we were talking about the Higgs boson, let's talk about its cousin that wasn't quite as popular that didn't get quite as much press.
Yeah, sometimes you have two discoveries and one outshines the other.
Yeah, nicely put, outshines the other, because what we're talking about is dark matter that specifically doesn't shine. That's been one of the problems, is that we can't see it because
it's
not
gravitationally.
Yeah. Yes. It turns out that an international team of astrophysicists have stated that in a paper that they have empirically observed a dark matter filament, something that has been theorized for quite some time.
How would you describe a dark matter filament?
It is something that is relatively narrow. In other words, on the order of like maybe a few light years across.
Oh God, that's pretty small.
Yeah.
But it's humongous.
But has a length on the order of, say, millions or tens of millions, or in this case, it's 3 million light years or so thick, but it's 58 million light years from end to end.
Got it.
What is this?
A dark matter filament. It's an item that is very dense, has a very strong gravitational pull because there is all that mass there.
Okay.
But it exists in between two other gravitational items, such as a galaxy cluster.
Why do we call it a filament? A filament to me means
because they arrange themselves in a web-like structure around the universe.
I didn't know anything about this. So what you're saying is there's a theory about dark matter that it produces large structures, and we're talking millions of light years large. And it produces these structures that then have a gravitational force because of the existence of these giant structures.
Right. Because most of the mass in our universe is stuff we can't see.
Right.
Like 98%, something ridiculous like that.
Meaning that we don't have any way of detecting it except for gravitational effects.
Yeah,
so that's
we can
why
observe
we've been calling it dark
that
matter.
If there was matter there, then the gravity would be affecting the universe the way it does. But for example, our own spiral galaxy would be spinning differently if what we saw was all that was there.
So right. we could actually physically pass through the region of space, you know, occupied by dark matter, or light could pass through and not be affected whatsoever in any way whatsoever, except gravitationally.
That's the idea, at least.
Yeah.
Only in that we haven't seen any other samples.
Small white lies, oversimplifications, blah,
right.
blah, blah,
yeah,
blah.
Go
blah.
On, go yeah. on. So the theory, so there's a theory that it's producing large structures. How are we detecting that there's a filament, if you will, of this stuff?
How are we detecting
it? Well, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is, why a filament? Why not just stuff there? What I mean, why the web-connected thing? I hadn't heard that idea.
That I'm not sure, as I'm not an astrophysicist, so I'm not going to even attempt it, lest I sound you know, more ignorant than I actually am. I just report the news. I don't make
all
it.
Right, all right, all right.
I don't understand it. No.
Well, let's move on. Since we're talking about particle physics, let's do some more particle
physics. Yeah, but the article will be up on our website
yes,
later.
You can read it thoroughly and be as confused as us.
Which will have a link to the paper as well. So if you right. are astrophysically inclined.
I've also putting up a link to our July 11, 2009 show, which was with particle physicist Linda Carpenter. Mm-hmm. 2009. That was 2 years ago. Three years ago.
You know,
wait, I can do math.
So funny about that episode and also about a lot of my conversations with her, right? She knows things that I have no clue how much she knows about things that I never interact with in my life. And so whenever I try to form a question,
I ask a question,
she's like she kind of twitches and she's like, wait, that question is nonsensical. Do you mean to ask this or this or this or this? It's kind of interesting.
That's cool.
Or as some notable scientists have said, that's not even wrong.
Right. Particle physics, atoms.
So I want to talk about atoms some more, since we're in the realm of the very, very small. Now, I mean, normally I spend...
You just did very, very large, too, though, but go on.
Well, let's say... Well,
we're talking about grains of sand within football fields.
We'll say the non-quotidian from a scale perspective.
Quotidian?
Quotidian.
Move
yeah,
on,
Ben. Yeah, I just
ben.
Used that word.
Go on.
It totally works. The non-everyday. Yeah, look it up in the dictionary. Anyway. Sorry, Miles is usually the one correcting me, so... But in any case, a Griffin University research team has, for the first time, been able to photograph the shadow of a single atom.
Okay.
It's kind of wacky. That's pretty much the story.
What was the shadow cast by?
What was the element? Yeah. It's one of those, ytterbium. It's one of the ones that has... three consonants at the beginning, and I don't know how to pronounce it. Y-T-T-E-R-B-I-U-M. I have no idea.
Okay.
Anyway, but I think it's 90, or like number 90 or something like that.
70 something, isn't it?
But it's, yeah, okay, well, Miles, you look it up.
I'll be right again.
But in any case, it's a pretty heavy atom, and they exposed this atom to a very, very specific frequency of light. Now, this frequency, so... One thing about light, if you kind of think of light as a wave, right, there is actually a distance between the peaks depending on the frequency. So the higher the frequency, the closer the peaks are together, and the higher, the smaller things you can observe. We actually can't observe using visible light anything smaller than an atom. And even observing an atom is ridiculously difficult. So the way we were able to do this is we used a very, very specific frequency of light. And if we were to deviate from that frequency by one part in a billion, like very, very small fraction, we wouldn't be able to see the shadow anymore.
Oh, so you're talking about this light frequency that we're doing had something to do with the effects of that atom. So that atom was subtracting that or interfering with that.
Exactly,
frequency.
Yeah, something like that. Mm. So it kind of looks like, the image kind of looks like two ripples in a pool of molten lava.
Yeah, cool.
But if you imagine it with a little black spot in the middle, and that's the shadow.
Awesome.
And then, it's kind of an awesome picture, just knowing what
kind
it is.
Kind of a geek bit, huh? Because we can't see it.
Right.
Well,
I guess,
I wanted to talk a bit more about it.
What would be a way of describing this, though? This would be like the wave effects you would get by throwing a pebble into a pond, but then you need to throw another pebble in just the right way so that the waves go in just the right.
Yeah, it's possible it's done that way. I mean, I'm not really sure if it's what it's interfering with.
Yeah,
it's not like the atom's much smaller than the wavelength. That's not the. I mean, that's
but the
not
atom
it.
Is also vibrating.
Right. It has characteristics as well. Basically.
So that's what I think was going on.
I would agree. Here. I would agree.
Yeah. So they actually keep the atom still long enough to, you know, get enough photons to take its photo, if you will.
Interesting.
So the way that you do that is you hold it in free space with with some kind of electrical forces kind of.
All right.
Thing.
It's time to start
like
talking.
Really small tweezers, right? No, I'm kidding.
But it is ytterbium.
Ytterbium.
And it is atomic number
70?
70.
Miles was right.
I thought you said 70 something.
Well, said 70, it is 70 it? Something. It's 70.
Well, at least I got that it was an order of two to 10, whatever.
I was interacting with someone this week, and they
I'm
said they heard
victory
their show.
And going home now.
Oh, only because you got the last victory. Anyway, Lyle.
Show's not over yet. I'm sure there'll be more victories. Let's talk something other than particle physics, would you please? Well,
sure. Twitter has been in the news quite a bit lately. They've been struggling over many years. Where is free speech versus trying to get a good signal to noise ratio on their site or within their network?
Twitter, of course, is this online web service that allows you to post very short comments, and people can follow each other, and by that, build a network of people following and communication in small fragments of content.
Yeah,
this is done for sharing images,
completely destroying the narrative of individuals, but increasing the narrative of populations.
Yes, go on. Good idea. Good.
And so, Twitter is looking at ways of clamping down on anonymous replies, because a lot of times they end up, someone has no followers, some user has no followers and no other comments, but they reply to other things. Chances are they're just trolling. They're an advertisement troll, mm-hmm. or something like that. And, you know, or they're abusive and racist.
You know, trolling is a term online to get people angry. So a troll is someone that kind of abuses you verbally or textually.
Or like pokes you with a stick.
Yeah, and
more.
The only purpose of them
demands
is to
your
get,
attention.
The only purpose is for you to then react with them. And they have won as soon as you've done that. So they'll say something really inflammatory. And the thing you do in a message board in general, you just ignore it. And no one interacts with it, and the troll gets bored.
So
but
Miles,
if you interact with it, you go into a deep pit of despair.
So Miles is a successful troll. Because I always respond to him.
Only because you're responding to him.
Exactly, yeah.
Miles, go on.
But there is a wrinkle to this, which is, it would be easy to say, like, oh, well, someone doesn't have any followers and they only do replies, then just ban them. Except that was a primary way that dissidents in repressive regimes were able to get their message out.
Right.
Was they would reply to a specific, you know, topic and get that information out. And they had to be anonymous.
Right.
Because otherwise,
so what you're saying is
happen.
That if you wanted to be in a space where you weren't persecuted, you make a new Twitter account and then you start the conversation with that Twitter account. And no one's following you. It's a brand new account and it's making commentary that might be very important because it represents a hidden voice.
It's commentary that would not be visible otherwise.
Right,
has
right. Because there's no way that
quite a bit.
There's no way that Ben Jaffe is going to make commentary about anything because then you would slam him and complain. But if he actually wanted to correct you without you slamming and complaining about him, he'd make a new account and then you'd have to listen to it for a second at least mm-hmm. before you understood that it was somebody you knew and didn't like. But let's move on. What are they doing to deal with this? They're not turning off these accounts that are brand new and only replying. What are they doing?
But they are using some heuristics to try to look for the patterns. Because they are more likely to be
spam bots, basically.
Spam bots, yeah.
Yeah.
Or just annoying people.
Annoying people creating accounts.
So, but they can look to see, they're looking to see patterns. And this is happening with Facebook, this is happening with other large scale crowdsourcing, is you're looking for patterns to see, does this look like a conversation having to do with an important topic, or is this something that looks like useless filler, you know, noise that's drowning out the signal.
Right. How do you analyze that kind of thing?
When you have large amounts of data, it actually ends up being somewhat easier.
You just look at the Sigma stuff? I remember you talking about that.
Well, it's much the same thing as when you look at Amazon. And Amazon says, you look like you would be interested in this type of thing. And they've been
instead
kind
it's,
of...
You look like a spammer.
Yeah, they've been a little bit off. For me, maybe I just have very unusual taste.
It's tricky because, of course, that that voice that's saying something that other people can't say if there's a lot of them that say similar things, that is a little bit like spam. I mean, it's a tricky thing to determine, right? You're trying to find that gem of interesting information in a sea of content, and the only thing that's similar about it in some sense is that it's by a new user and it's something that's not being said other places.
But the trolls will end up being very similar on many different places. So you can look for that pattern.
So you say, okay, we're talking about politics in Eastern Europe here, but over here we're talking about how cool Coca-Cola is, and the same type of comments are showing up. That must be spam. There's nothing related to
those
things.
People are talking about bodily orifice
in both places.
In both places.
And has no relevance. Yeah. Interesting.
And which then goes along with Twitter always having to run this tightrope of government requests for their information. Which, by the way, be interesting to know that law enforcement of the U.S. is by far the largest group asking for requests for information from Twitter.
Yeah,
in the world.
Okay, so right now, even though we talked about that as a repressive regime and individuals trying to communicate in a repressive regime by making a new account and then communicating through that account, hopefully getting that message out. In reality, the people, the governments that are the most active in communicating with Twitter, at least on what's going on with their users, is the U.S. courts.
Right. For example, so Twitter just getting knocked down from fighting a New York court for having access to an Occupy Wall Street protester.
Interesting.
And they recently lost that.
Twitter lost that?
Yeah.
To be clear, Twitter, I mean, for people that aren't engaged in the Twitter space very much, it's around the news all the time. You see this at whatever thing. I think we're KOSP geeks, but I'm at Lyle, L-Y-L-E. I've had an account for a long time. Awesome.
Lucky you.
I know. Bow down. But anyway, that idea, that is a communication mechanism, kind of like email, but in no way like email. But the point of it, the reason I want to I'm talking about this is that right
millions
now
of people with tiny megaphones.
Yeah, millions of people with tiny megaphones. That's a great way of explaining it.
And if enough people are saying the same thing, you end up hearing that above many of the other voices.
You start hearing the crowd in general. It's a good analogy. And the point right now, of course, that because the tools are so integrated with our smart devices, it is very common for posts to emerge that track where you are kind of accidentally, right? So Twitter knows the IP address of where you are. Your phone knows the location very specifically, and sometimes actually that's part of the app that you're using that submits it to Twitter as well. So when you start looking at an active user, someone like someone that would be Occupy Wall Street, they want to let people know why they're posting that they're down on Wall Street, right? That they're down at the park. That's part of the information that's important. So as somebody that watches what's going on there in a political sense, you start following these people that have a voice. They happen to be in the location and they're communicating where they are all the time and kind of what they're saying. So if you then look at that information and can track it back to the human being, you could probably prosecute them for trespassing or whatever, depending on where they were. So Twitter's information, though it's only little 140 character bytes, has a lot of data about individuals, and that privacy line is an interesting one, and it's being fought in the courts right now with Twitter, who happens to be, I think, the group of people that developed Twitter. I think they're very much in that space that they want this to be strong for the individual, not so much for the government.
Right. And they actually have been working towards this with what they call a transparency tool, which is Twitter is releasing government requests, saying like, yes, this is a request we've gotten, and here we go.
They're informing people that they're doing
that. Yeah, so that they have some type of, I want to say paper trail, but it's not really paper, is it?
No.
But some sort of record.
Well, yeah, but, I mean, that's been a common thing. When you get a court order. Yeah, when you get a court order, like a local ISP, for example, that I communicate with quite a bit, when they get court orders, they do get court orders, I'm assuming, and they do follow on them. And one of the rules is you can't tell the clients, right? So it's a very creepy business to be in, that space where the federal government gives you a court order, you're supposed to do it. It definitely impinges on the privacy of the individual. You can't even tell the individual that your service is doing that. So that Twitter's starting to kind of surface what is being requested and how. That way, people that are trying to protect themselves and their privacy can compensate by using things like onion routers and such. But let's go on, shall we? Good?
Yeah, just one more thing. But I wanted to give a point of context. This was Twitter, and Twitter gets, 849 requests from governments to get information. 679 of them were from the U.S. government, so very large proportion of them. By comparison, let's look at Google, who is also a big treasure trove of information for people making whatever searches they might desire. And there, American authorities requested over 3,800 queries for by court order.
Wow.
It's a lot.
Sorry, in the second half of 2011. Let me give a time frame there.
You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Miles Elam and Ben Jaffe. We are taking calls with questions and comments about technology. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. I'll give out that phone number in a minute after we do our Geek Bit. Ben, you want to start?
Yeah. Where were you guys for 4th of July? Did you guys see fireworks?
Yeah, Scotts Valley.
Yeah, fantastic. So I was up here. I didn't see fireworks, but I'm from San Diego, and there was a hullabaloo down there. For the 4th of July fireworks display, it was pretty much ruined because they sent a signal to the barges to set the timing. They were doing one of those timed firework displays to the music on the radio and everything like that. And all the fireworks, all of them, went up all at once. And they got a 15-second insane explosion-like fireworks display. No one was hurt or anything. It was totally fine. But there are a couple of videos of this. This happened 5 minutes before it was supposed to start, and it was supposed to be an 18-minute show. But instead, just...
And it was all pretty close to the ground, too. It wasn't... It didn't get the altitude.
Yeah. We were watching the video before the show, and you know how fireworks usually go way, way high up, and then they pop. At least Miles and my hypothesis is that a lot of them, especially in the middle of that 15 seconds, started going off in the middle, and it was because of maybe heat or something like that. Maybe it just got really hot.
The projectile started, just burned as it went through the flame.
I have no idea what how.
Yeah, normally you have that initial takeoff. It burns through the fuel as it goes up, and then at the very end, it ignites the actual color portion.
Right.
Or the
That's why it just was like throwing fireworks in a fire.
Incredibly impressive video, though.
All right, up at geekspeak.org. Geek bits are things that you got to see to believe. Miles, you got one?
As a matter of fact, I don't.
Okay. Geekspeak on KUSP is supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support to businesses and tech support for home computers. Home and Small Business Tech specializes in protecting data and has been providing data storage, recovery, and virtualization and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBTech.com. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Ben Jaffe and Miles Elam. We're taking calls with questions and comments about technology. You can ask us anything you'd like. We'd be happy to address your thoughts and concerns and questions about technology. 1-800-655-5877. Again, that's 1-800-655-5877. Ben, as we're waiting for calls to be plugged in, what's going on with headlights?
All right, so I love this story. It's fantastic. So one of the issues in inclement weather is that the headlights, the light from the headlights becomes impaired by the rain and the snow or things like that. And so it turns out that there's this prototype headlight system that they're developing, at least researching, that uses a digital projector.
Who's they? Sorry.
They?
Researchers.
researchers. I don't have the... I think Carnegie
on,
Mellon
Ben.
University?
Sorry about you.
Troll. anyway. The cool thing about this, though, it's not just a light as a headlight. It's actually a projector. And what it does is it looks ahead and it bounces light off of the raindrops or the snowdrops or whatever, figures out where they are, figures out where they're going based on all these different variables and everything, and removes the light from that little cone of light on the projector. So
now we do this. We do this at UCSC in digital art. We do this kind of projection mapping stuff all the time. That is fantastic. Okay,
you're
so
illuminating everything except for the subjects in the art examples, and in the headlight examples, you're illuminating everything except for the things you don't want, which are the raindrops.
Okay,
the individual raindrops.
So I'm assuming what they're doing, they're looking at the location and the brightness of something, and then reducing it if it's too close and too bright.
Yes.
That's fantastic. Okay, let's try to explain this again, because it is a little weird.
Yeah,
so let's say I'm standing in front of your supercar, we'll call it Kit, and I've got a white sheet of paper, and behind me is a whole bunch of other stuff you want to see. If you shined your headlights on it, what happened with that white piece of paper right in front of the car would be very, very bright.
Yeah.
The thing behind would be a little bit less.
Yeah, the inverse square law, it would be much brighter.
Right, and so you can effectively, in a snow situation, all those pieces of snow are like that piece of paper, really close and really bright.
Mm-hmm.
So now what you do, instead of shining a light out, you use a projector, like a movie projector, and instead of doing a white image, you do white with a black square, and you line that black square up exactly where my sheet of paper is. And you do that extremely fast, probably multiple times a second. And what you the effect is, though everything around me is light, including my really cool t-shirt and my pants and my face, is lit up with your cool Kit car, Miles, you stopped with the music thing. The sheet of paper has no light from your car on it at all. It would just be ambient, so it'd be darker, and therefore it wouldn't be super bright. That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And these... So you can talk while he's doing this.
Oh, yeah, I can ignore Miles like no problem.
But the capture takes 5 milliseconds.
That's
and
fast.
The system latency is 13 milliseconds. So
now, are they doing two cameras, one for each headlight? Do you know?
I'm not sure about that. They must
Is this
have.
Just prototype? This must be just prototype. They're probably just using one at this point. It's harder to do with two systems.
Yeah, but just a couple statistics about this that really boggle my mind. First of all, the operating range of this is 3 to 4 meters in front of the projector. So, you know, again, inverse square law, the things that are brightest are the things that you want to remove. And it turns out research has shown that 3 to 4 meters is about where the worst of the rain or everything is. If you're going 30 kilometers per hour, so for U.S. people, that's roughly 20 miles per hour, you can remove 70%. And then if you're going 100 kilometers per hour, which is almost exactly 60 miles an hour, you can remove 15 or 20% of the rain from that. And then another interesting statistic that's relevant to the story, but also just generally interesting. If you're in a heavy rain, apparently water is only 2 to 3% of the air volume.
Really?
Yeah.
So it's not a lot. So you can see through it quite a bit if it's not lit up.
Exactly. But if you're lighting up the only solid things, oh, nice. You've got the real music. So this is less distracting.
Not at all.
Maybe it's just as distracting. But yeah, if you can light up just the solid material in the air, then you're set.
Right.
Or, no, I'm sorry. Light up everything but the solid material
right.
in the air.
So it's actually, they don't have to do a lot of detection. They just have to do location. I mean, well, they do. And I'm wondering if they're doing that with infrared, if they're using a scanning system, if they're just capturing the projector, and then as soon as they see a flash, they remove that. So it lessens the brightness a little bit because you can turn it on, turn it off before the eye really registers a lot of photons.
Yeah. By the way, this is MIT's Media Lab.
Of course it is.
Of course it is. They're awesome. The City Car Project. And then the other thing I want to say is that this has probably got to be really expensive. If it comes to market anytime in the next 5 years.
It's research, baby.
Yeah. But yeah. I mean, research... This stuff is—it's the stuff of the future.
So
it's,
Ben,
it's almost
so Ben,
magic.
The reason we're doing this kind of stuff in art space is that you take two projectors and you throw them on the floor at a 30 degree angle from each other, right? So they're both hitting the floor, and then a person walks into that space. Now they're going to cast a shadow on both those projectors, unless, of course, you only have one projector imaging the floor. And the other projector just compensates filling in any shadows, right? So you detect the shadow of the first projector and you add back in that image on the floor from where your shadow is being cast. And therefore, you have no shadow and you walk through the space and there's a projection on the floor.
Only 30 degrees away from each other.
You don't need a lot, depending on the angle. You know, we haven't done a lot of this. We just theorized it and, you know. Anyway.
You can also do some really strange things where a person walks into a theater space and you only illuminate them with a projector. Only.
Yes.
And so you have this bizarre, you know, floating figure in the middle of this pitch dark space. Of course, projectors have projector black. It's not pitch black.
Right.
It's really cool stuff.
You know what's also cool? Aptos, California.
What's in Aptos, California?
Well, Elizabeth's in Aptos. Hi.
Hi, you guys. How are you?
Good. What's your question?
I have a question about Twitter and clout scores, but I don't know if you guys are active enough to help me with that.
Which scores? Clout scores?
Clout. Mm-hmm.
So how high your ranking is in the certain topic areas that you're talking about?
Oh, yeah, I guess it has to do with topics. I learned a little bit about this in a social media class recently, but my question has to do with the fact that I'm trying to clean up my inactive. You know what that is. I don't know if we should explain, but it's like if you have a lot of inactive people that you're following, it's not a good thing.
That's right. So should we talk about clout? Are we talking about clout or cloud? I didn't hear you say.
Oh, clout, K-L-O-U-T, yeah. Like Thomas.
So, yeah, let me explain that real quick to everybody. Clout is this service, clout.com, that basically can rank how important you are in the Twitter space based on how many people are following what you're saying and how many people you follow, right? So the basic idea is if you follow no one and no one follows you, you're unimportant. If you follow 10,000 people and 7 people follow you, you might be less than unimportant, right? Because that means that people really want to avoid you even though you're trying to engage the community. So that score...
It's tricky because, you know, I try to follow back everyone that seems like a real person that... You know, that doesn't,
right.
you know, spend their whole thing, tweeting about themselves
following,
or swearing. You know, it's an interactive space, so you want to do that.
I took on the perspective early on about clout to totally ignore it and remove it from my thought and process. I've never made an account, and I don't even like it. And the reason is that that's not actually how human beings perceive importance algorithmically, right? It's much more – and having an algorithm that determines that is a – it's kind of a – It's like having the popular girls in junior high rank everybody. You know, it's just kind of disgusting. Now, at the same point, it is an interesting service. Ben, do you want to add something to this?
Oh yeah, I just want to say I kind of in my own brain, at least, I liken it to trying to hack your search engine optimization, right?
Yeah.
So back in the 90s, that worked pretty well. You could put tons of keywords in invisible fonts at the bottom of your page, and all the search engines would say, oh, they've got all these keywords, they must be important. But nowadays, you've got Google, and their PageRank algorithm is just phenomenal, and you're not going to hack around it. You're not going to trick it. And so the best way to get higher search to get higher in the search results is to actually have a good website with a lot of content.
Right.
So I would imagine that this is a similar kind of thing. Facebook, Twitter, if you're actually engaging with the community, you're probably going to have more influence in that way.
That's what I do, and I, without ever knowing about clout, last year CNN called me because they saw a bunch of my tweets, and they didn't wind up interviewing me, but they talked to me, and so so the thing is that is it important to clean up my inactives? The reason I'm asking is that the service that was recommended to me in this social media class and all the other ones I looked into were either very clunky or very inaccurate.
Right.
So I just kind of, my question was, is there something good to clean up my inactives? But maybe you're saying it doesn't really even matter.
Well, it matters in the sense that your clout score is going to change depending on how many inactives you have following. That's true, that depending on how you engage in the community, your score is going to change. Whether that score is important or not is up to you. If you want to affect that score, then yeah, you do need to play those games. And I don't inactive accounts to me, I mean, I probably follow mostly inactive accounts, right? Because I add people, I only remove people when they annoy me, right? When I'm reading too much about what they had for breakfast and it's not interesting food, I stop following them. So the people that are quiet actually end up kind of, collecting. And I think in that sense of removing those kind of makes sense. But then again, those are people that actually I probably care more about, right? That Miles hasn't done any Twitter for a while. If he does, and I happen to spot it. You have?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm mostly retweeting other people's stuff.
Maybe I stopped following you.
It's harder than 2,000 people. It's like just, I follow a lot, and I have a lot that follow me. But yeah, I hear what you're saying. And I agree that the idea of, being the prettiest Twitter account in the high school, I don't like those kind of things. I just sort of wondered, in terms of what you're saying, if it's sort of like the equivalent of SEO, then I put a lot into my Twitter.
I think that's all you have to really...
You
need to make sure that you're... I get that. I think the most important thing for you is to make sure that you produce good content, right? Mm-hmm. Because if someone like me has a whole bunch of accounts just flofloating there that doesn't, not working on that, and yet... let me put it this way. Let's say 10% of the population on Twitter doesn't pay attention to those dead accounts at all. They're just there, but they're producing really good content. So there's 10% of people are producing content. If they're not removing those old followers, then the algorithms to determine clout will start ignoring them, right? So if you do, because the clout system idea is trying to do is determine if you're important or not. If you determine that it doesn't matter that you're following dead accounts and you still produce good content and CNN still calls you and your content is healthy and strong and you get followers because of that, then it will soon be such that it doesn't matter if you're following bad accounts or not.
Yeah, clout will change their algorithms.
No, I do. I post good stuff.
Yeah, just like Google changed and all the search engines changed their ranking algorithms,
Absolutely. Miles, what's your account on Twitter? Is it TTKFM?
No, it's Miles Elam.
It's Miles Elam? I can't find you.
I should say, though...
I don't have much clout.
I should say, though, if anyone is looking to try to make their clout score higher, we're not the people to ask because we don't really know.
Well, we don't care about it as much.
Yeah. I mean, we kind of all actively don't care about it.
Yeah. But thank you so much. The other thing is, of course, don't follow people just because because they're popular. I mean, what I try to do is I only follow people that I actually want to read.
Oh,
and so the following count decreases quite a bit. But of course, I determine on how much annoyance their content is, not necessarily.
Well, I also follow people that follow me that seem like decent people, because to me, that's what Twitter
absolutely
is. You
absolutely
know, you kind of reciprocate unless they're really off the wall. So,
sure. What's your Twitter account?
You know, I've hand vetted all of my 2,500 people, you know, over the years, and that's, I don't know any other way to do that. So.
Right. What's your Twitter account, Elizabeth?
It's PSICHIC. Psychic, because I'm a psychic.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. Well, I probably won't follow you, but but I love that you called in to ask us about this.
I don't post much about my work, which is probably a failing. I post photographs and things about Santa Cruz and news. And
yeah, I'll probably follow you then. I like Santa Cruz. Hey, thanks, Elizabeth, for calling
in. Thank you so much.
Take care.
Bye.
God, it's those jokes about psychic I always want to engage with. Like, wait, why is a psychic asking a question, right? My first response is, don't they know the answer? Is that me just being a jerk? Am I a jerk?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
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 Pretty much.
Hi, this is Jerk Speak. I mean, Geek Speak. Jamie from Santa Cruz, welcome. What's your question?
I have a sort of a bothersome, silly question, and then I have a more important question. My first bothersome, silly question is to do with my marketing problem. And that is, no, with my cell phone problem.
Okay.
I'm kind of a Luddite, so I got one finally, and everybody said I should have one, and I had a home phone, and I have an office somewhere else, but I'm not there very much, and I don't travel very much, and blah, blah, blah. So I get this Virgin Mobile thing, and I didn't like it very much. It was sort of some kind of Android, and, you know, I paid for it, not paid for it, blah, blah, blah. So now I don't understand this. I finally was shown by a salesman what an Apple thing looks like. Oh, it's really much better, so then it's more money. So I'm sort of cheap, so then I didn't buy it. So then they tell me, well, but this month you lost Verizon, you can only buy a Sprint. So then I'm thinking, okay, wait a minute, how do I decide when to pop on one of these? Because every month the deals change, the technology changes. Do I want Sirius? Do I not? I don't understand when you decide to buy. You just do it on impulse?
Well, usually, as someone who's really into mobile devices, for example, you'll wait until the device is about to be announced, which for the iPhone will be sometime next month or the month after. It depends upon what Apple's kind of tight-lipped about that. But there's going to be a new one out very soon. And so, yeah, that choice between getting the new hotness or you can pay less for what you would be buying today.
So yeah,
the
last
hotness will cost less than the new hotness, so it's really sort of a question of just preference. It's sort of, at some point, silly, but because all of them work, it's just, I like the sound or the woman talking or whatever.
Well, my phone is 2.5 years old at this point, and it's kind of on its last legs, but that's probably because I dropped it a few times. But if I actually had a new one of those phones, it would be totally fine, you know? Like, I would be able to do everything I need to do. Sure, absolutely, the new phones are sleeker and more awesome and faster, maybe have different functionality or whatever. But, I mean, ultimately, it comes down to how much money are you willing to spend to have the latest and greatest.
Okay, thank you. So now I'll get to my more important problem, because you just said that SEO is basically useless. And I am dependent on my website to generate business for my therapy business.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a little concerned that you said that, because, of course, I realize that all the people who want to sell services who are SEO people are making the case, you know, you still need this, and you can still do, if not keywords, now the greatest thing is links and all this stuff. What do I do about determining what I should be doing? Because my whole living, at least my part-time living, I'm sort of retired, is dependent on whether I do the right thing.
Well, you know,
Psychology Today seems to show up as number one all the time.
Right.
They must have some method to their madness.
Okay, we should probably have a whole show on search engine optimization, because
I
frown upon it all the time. I can't stand it.
Let's be sure what we're talking about here, because SEO just means that you have a website that is easy to index.
Stop. Let's all stop for a second, Miles. I'm going to interrupt you because I'm looking at the clock and it's gone on to 4 minutes. And the problem is there's too much to talk about. That's why I want to do a whole show on it. Because the truth is that the topic is complex, right? You've got marketers trying to sell the service. You've got websites being indexed. You've got customers you know, customers like Jamie here trying to make sure that his site is viewable, and all those have different reasons and actions to take on. And unfortunately, three more minutes left of the show.
I want to correct myself really fast.
Go ahead and correct
yourself. Because I just want to be clear that I didn't say that SEO is not useful or is useless or whatever, but I did say that SEO hacking, like trying to hack your search result up higher, it doesn't really work so well. But having good content, that's what the SEO people will tell you
Most likely a good SEO
person. And they'll tell you how to do it, too.
Okay, Miles, you, right.
And that was actually similar to what I was going to say, which is how do you improve your SEO? Make a good, useful site.
Right.
Like the more useful, the more good information you have on there.
And there are some complexities that an analyst Indeed. Could tell you about your site that could improve.
So a few weeks from now, will you promise to do a show?
Yeah, I'll promise to do a show right now. Will I do it within a few weeks? Yeah, I think so. I think that we will.
Maybe.
Well, it's one of those things that people come up to me all the time and are like, I paid this person to tell me how to do website stuff. And I said, well, you could have just asked me lunch. I could have told you how to make websites. And then people go to trainings and they have a lot of information that maybe isn't actually very helpful. And I'm like, who is sharing this information with people? And am I missing the step? I don't think so. So it's a complex problem. So if you're someone that does search engine optimization as your job, you're an analyst, you help people with this, please do contact the Geeks. We're geeks@geekspeak.org. Jamie, thank you so much for the call.
Thank you.
We will do a show in the near future. And the first person to call me that's a search engine optimization, I will talk to you and find out if you're a marketeer or a technologist that can actually help people. That'll be my role. This is GeekSpeak. We're taking calls with questions and comments on technology. As you know by now, we only have a couple more minutes left. I do want to let you know that coming up next, I've got to do that later. Something confusing to people. All right. Let's go on to say that everything we talk about today on GeekSpeak is available at geekspeak.org. And we do make comments on every story we bring up. This is Central Coast Public Radio Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org. Miles, Phil, for 10 seconds, would you?
Thanks, everyone, for listening. For 10 seconds, really?
You got a minute.
Oh, I got a minute. I was about to say, like, so I was just thinking in terms of when we were talking about how to become more popular and stuff like that. I couldn't help but think about a Geico commercial that came up recently, where it's the popular girls from middle school.
Uh huh.
Where they would say the same thing over and over again.
I don't think it got picked up on the mic. This is the worst close of GeekSpeak ever. But luckily, coming up next is Car Talk, a professionally, highly produced radio show from NPR. That's going to start just momentarily. Again, this is KOSP. My name is Lyle Troxel. Ben Jaffe in the air room. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
Miles Elam as well. And Rick Philman answering calls. If you have questions for us throughout the week, you're welcome to leave us email at geekspeak.org. Just click on the Contact Us page. And of course, our email address is actually geeks@geekspeak.org. Please don't spam us. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org.